Is there finally help for restless legs?
Risk of end-stage kidney disease following live kidney donation.
What does pricing of alcohol have to do with use of alcohol?
And varying doses of HPV vaccine and genital warts.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on February 14th, 2014. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and vice chairman of medicine at the University of Texas in San Antonio.
Rick, how about if we start with this HPV issue, the HPV vaccine, and adequate numbers of doses of the vaccine in order to prevent HPV disease, in this case, genital warts. That's in the Journal of the American Medical Association.
The quadrivalent HPV vaccine basically vaccinates against types 16 and 18 HPV infection. And those are the ones that are associated with multiple different cancers, including cervical cancer. But they also protect against types 6 and 11, which causes about 90% of what are known as condyloma lata or genital warts. If our listeners aren't aware, it's recommended that individuals receive 3 doses for maximum benefit. The real question is, what happens if one receives fewer doses? You can do that by assessing what the risk is of cervical cancer over the course of decades, or since this vaccine also prevents genital warts, which occurs within months of infection, look at that incidence. They examine the association between the quadrivalent HPV vaccination and the first occurrence of genital warts in relation to the vaccine dose. And what they discovered was in over 1 million females that were vaccinated between 2006 and 2010, maximum protection was afforded by giving all 3 doses. No surprise. It reduced the incidence of genital warts by about 82%. But even those individuals that received 2 doses had an incidence decrease of 71%, and even 1 dose by 69%.
Okay. While that's really good news for those who don't complete the full series, clearly completing the full series is better. I would also suggest that warts are a stand-in for cervical cancer with regard to HPV. And moreover, I would cite a recent study that shows that the rate of uptake, that's the utilization of this vaccine in the United States, is only about 15% of adolescent young girls. And we know that right now the CDC is recommending that boys too receive the full series of this vaccine to prevent oropharyngeal cancer. So I'm going to say, okay, this is great, but I can't say that we would stand behind people only receiving a suboptimal number of doses.
Elizabeth, I couldn't agree with you more. This is not a surrogate for whether or not less dosing is protective for cervical cancer, and it doesn't address the other issue that only a minority of people that are eligible receive appropriate vaccination. So I'm glad you mentioned those things, Elizabeth.
Let's turn from here then to a really common problem and one that I'm going to share that there's a very interesting folk remedy for. That's restless leg syndrome, and that's in the New England Journal of Medicine. Do we have something that helps?
This study looked at what's known as moderate to severe restless leg syndrome. It's also known as Willis-Ekbom disease. It's predominantly nocturnal, and it's this distressing urge to move one's legs while asleep. It actually disrupts sleep profoundly, and it often requires treatment for years, if not for life. And it affects 2-3% of Caucasians. This study looked at 2 different medications, the short-acting dopamine agonists, pramipexole. There's a medicine called pregabalin. Most of our listeners would know by Lyrica, which acts on an entirely different receptor. And in this study, they compared 52 weeks of treatment with pregabalin at 300 milligrams versus pramipexole at either 0.25 or 0.5 milligrams. The pregabalin was more effective than the pramipexole. 71% of pregabalin patients said they had a significant reduction in symptoms versus 47% treated with pramipexole. So this is good news for individuals that have moderate to severe restless leg syndrome.
It sure is, because, gosh, it's a really troublesome condition. What about the side effect profile related to pregabalin? And especially, these folks are often aging, and they may have a number of comorbidities. So what do we say about that?
The side effect that causes most concern is suicide ideation. There were 6 cases of suicide ideation in the group that received pregabalin. And I'll remind you that there were about 182 that received that versus about 3 that received pramipexole. Absolute numbers are relatively small. We don't know what causes it right now. It's of interest that 2 different drugs targeting 2 different receptors are effective in relieving the symptoms.
It's good news that we have something that's been looked at closely and been shown to be effective. As I said at the beginning, I will share that one of the folk remedies I've heard for this is taking a bar of soap and putting it underneath one's mattress. You really do see this, believe it or not. If you look on the internet, you can find that people recommend this. It's sort of an interesting strategy. Let's turn now to The Lancet. Minimal pricing of alcohol.
This was an interesting study because it involved economic analysis. My ability to interpret this, I have to give credit to Doug Huff, who was one of my teachers during my MBA there at Hopkins. It's the use of an econometric analysis and an epidemiologic analysis put together to ask and answer the question, if you increase the price of alcohol to a minimal level, how does that affect alcohol consumption? Does it reduce alcohol consumption among low-income people, or does it prevent people from taking it to excess, regardless of what their socioeconomic status is? So this study looked at the Scheffel alcohol policy model, or used it. It's a model that looks at alcohol purchasing and consumption, preferences among different populations, looked at price elasticity, and then also looked at the epidemiologic data, the harm and the cost associated with this excessive alcohol. And here's what they determined. If you raise it about 75 cents per unit of alcohol, a unit being about 8 grams or 10 mils, it does lead to an immediate reduction in alcohol, not among moderate drinkers, regardless of their socioeconomic setting, but against people that have very high alcohol intakes, so in harmful drinkers. Now, how does that translate to harm or benefit? Individuals in the lowest socioeconomic group, which comprised 42% of the sample, would accrue 82% of the reductions in premature deaths and 87% gain in terms of quality adjusted life years. The people who drink the most and are in the lowest socioeconomic sphere are those that receive the best or the most benefit.
This sounds to me an awful lot like the same model that we've seen relative to cigarettes, where when we raise the price, we are able to impact in a very positive way in my mind on people choosing not to smoke, and those who have fewer resources choosing more often not to smoke. So this makes some sense to me. The other thing that makes sense to me is that people who have a troubled relationship with alcohol or experience alcoholism, we know it knows no bounds with regard to socioeconomic class, but certainly could impact in a very positive way on people who have fewer resources if we raise the price. So I have to say, this sounds like a win to me.
It does. And hopefully this information will encourage the United Kingdom to proceed with efforts to have a floor or minimum unit pricing.
Excellent. So finally, this week, we're going to turn to a study that originated here at Johns Hopkins, our colleague Bob Montgomery, a transplant surgeon, on the risk of end-stage renal disease. That's in the Journal of the American Medical Association.
So, Elizabeth, in 2011, how many of the transplanted kidneys were provided by living donors as a percentage? Do you know?
I don't know.
42.5%, almost half. Once you've donated your kidney, what's that individual's risk of subsequently developing end-stage kidney disease? What this study did was look at every single living kidney donor over the last 20 years. That's pretty remarkable. There's over 96,000 of them. And they compared them to a similar low-risk group, so a comparison of two low-risk groups, over the course of a median of about 7.6 years, but a maximum of 15 years. Compared with matched healthy non-donors, the kidney donors did have an increased risk of end-stage renal disease. The estimated lifetime risk of end-stage renal disease in the donors was 90 per 10,000 donors versus 14 per 10,000 healthy non-donors. So there is an increase, but it's really a very, very small increase.
Good news, of course, for this increasingly popular option of living donation and also paired kidney donation, or the whole paradigm where they allow this sort of hopscotch thing to take place where lots of people get transplanted. I guess I still have just a couple concerns about it. I mean, I think it's a really wonderful thing, but I'm going to ask you, Rick, have you considered donating a kidney?
Elizabeth, I think that's a fair question. Yes, I have considered it. I think what the authors of this study recommend is the same regimen that I would adhere to, and that is for someone who's donated a kidney, we need to be very vigilant about following them very regularly to make sure they don't develop end-stage renal disease because they have no reserve because they only have a single kidney.
Okay, I'm going to leave that one there. I'm going to predict that I think that that's an option that many more people are choosing because it enables so many more people to actually get a kidney when they need one. So, Rick, all these studies this week are so good, I just don't know which one to pick for the blog. So you pick.
Well, thanks for allowing me to do that. I'm going to pick one that we wouldn't normally pick. Minimum unit pricing of alcohol. Would-be economists, they'll love this article. Let's post it.
All right, I'm going to let you get away with that, although my analysis is probably not going to be so good. So that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.